You're listening to the Capitol Hill Talks. I'm Andy Walters.
Kashama Sawant is running in the 2012 election for Washington State House of Representatives, District 43A, Seat 1. Sawant is unopposed in the August 7th primary election, and the general election takes place on November 6th, 2012. She holds a PhD in economics from North Carolina State University and currently teaches at Seattle Central Community College. Kashama, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So you're running as a candidate with the Socialist Alternative Party. What do you mean by socialism?
Well, what we mean by socialism is a system that actually works for the billions of people in the world. One of the things that I grew up hearing from everyone around me in India is that, oh, isn't this sad? You know, there's so much poverty while there are so many people who are, you know, wealthy. But people... they'll just talk about it as if it's a lamentable thing. Yes, it's so awful that there are people who are suffering, billions of people who are suffering. A lot of people have a lot of compassion for that, but they just stop there because they don't realize that poverty is, yes, it's lamentable, yes, it's awful, but it is not something that happens just incidentally. It is an actual product of a system where the system, the way it works is that it systematically takes wealth from the bottom layers and takes it to the top layer. That is the process that's happening.
And yeah, why do you think that socialism has a kind of a bad taste to it in the American conversation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean,
and is it legitimate?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mixed thing. I mean, first of all, of course, as we all know, you know, having grown up in the U.S., that a lot of that comes from the massive and very well orchestrated propaganda against the ideas of socialism that happened during the Cold War era. And so a lot of the people, especially not of our generation, but the older generations in our parents' generation, in the United States, did grow up surrounded by that sort of thing, you know, the godless communists, the evil, you know, the evil empire on that other side. But on the other hand, we also need to clarify that when we go out there and propose the idea of socialism as an alternative to capitalism, what we are proposing is not what we had in the Soviet Union. What existed for the most part in the Soviet Union was what we call... a degenerated worker state, meaning that the original, you know, the origins of the 1917 revolution, the Russian Revolution, were really genuine and really impressive, and that's what we should look to because it was a genuine workers' democracy, but it degenerated into what became known as Stalinism. But now, unfortunately, there's this confusion that Stalinism equates socialism. That's not true. It was a bureaucratic dictatorship. What was missing there was genuine democracy. You cannot have socialism. Socialism, like I said, is a system that should work for everyone. You know, everybody gets their basic needs satisfied. Everybody feels the feeling of political freedom. But you can't do that without democracy. If you want a just society where not only are everybody's needs met, but they're met in a high quality standard of living, that's not possible if there's a stranglehold from the top. You know, that's only possible if you have a genuine democratic decision making on how do we use, you know, in Capitol Hill, if we have $1 million, how do we use it? You know, do we use it to make sure that we have good quality public transit, or do we use it to make sure that a few rich people have a lot? I mean, whether it happens under capitalism or in a bureaucratic dictatorship, it's not going to work.
But I think you would agree that even that any system of government has to be constrained by budget at some point, right? So how can a socialist system of government provide all the good things that we would all want in a way better than our system can? Because after all, it seems like it would be constrained by budget. At the end of the day, you only have so much money to spend on certain things, right?
Right. That's absolutely correct. At the end of the day, yes, you will. I mean, and as an economist, I'm hardly about to deny that. That's very correct. But the reality is that if you're talking, I mean, it depends on what we're talking about, right? Let's say that for me, the priority, I mean, just going by my understanding of the state of the world today, under capitalism, we have a world where 18 million people are dying purely because they're too poor to have food to eat every year. 9 million of them are children under the age of 5. That's not what I call a system that works. I mean, that's a completely a spectacular failure of a system. But that's only one aspect of it. If you look at everything else, you know, the number of people who have access to housing, the number of people who have access to healthcare. I mean, this is a small proportion of the world that can actually have it. So capitalism as a system is failing, not because there are not enough resources, but because those resources are not distributed and not used in a way as to meet the needs of the people. So if we are talking about, do we have the budget or do we have the resources in the world to make sure that everybody who is alive today, I know people talk about the population explosion, but that's a completely different issue. Right now, everybody who's alive today, if we say, do we have enough resources to make sure that everybody has good quality housing, education, healthcare, a decent job, make sure that they have the basics in terms of, you know, having libraries, elder care facilities, care for disabled, you know, making sure everybody has laundry facilities so nobody's doing backbreaking work. You know, there's not much, doing this does not require much money. If the question is, do we have the wealth, the resources, the technology and science to solve these massive problems? Absolutely. There is no question that we have enough. But if your question is, do we have enough for everybody to be a millionaire? No. That is why you can either have a system where everybody has a really good standard of living, but nobody's a millionaire, or you can have a system where you have billions of people struggling with poverty and you have some millionaires. Yes, one of those two things is possible. You have to make a choice.
So do you think that there's something about the American ethos that wants to choose the second choice, which you just said, which is, yes, let's take the risk. We know that a lot of us are going to end up poor, but we, for some reason, we, whatever it is, we love the rich, or we like the idea of being rich, or we like the risk. Isn't there something in the American ethos that kind of points us actually in that direction?
I'm not so sure that that's what the American ethos is. I know that the media, the corporate media, tell us this. And you know, that's the first thing I was bombarded by, with when I first came to the U.S. You know, I was being told that Americans are just, you know, there's just something in the food they eat, maybe, that, you know, that just makes them so right-wing. But in reality, both my personal anecdotal experience and statistical experience, which I want to talk about in a second, completely defies that. I mean, when I actually interact with American people, they are every bit as compassionate and altruistic and caring and, you know, wise and logical as anybody else. So this idea that Americans somehow, you know, they sort of end up choosing a system against their own self-interest is really a reflection of the fact that they don't have much control over what kind of system, you know, ordinary Americans don't have much control over what kind of system they get. And that is exactly the problem. There is no mass political party that actually in any genuine way represents the needs and desires of ordinary people. And this is why people are forever stuck with thinking, okay, the Democrats are always betraying me. You know, if you're a union worker, what are you going to think, you know? Or if you're just an ordinary person who is struggling for a basic welfare, you're going to think, these people are not supporting me. I'm going to have to, vote Republican. And I don't even need to talk about this in general. Let's look at, you know, I'm running for a state race.
Yeah,
let's look at what's happening in the state of Washington. All right. Why do people end up voting in Tim Iman initiatives? I mean, they're absolutely, you know, reprehensible initiatives. Why do people vote for it? This is clearly against their self-interest. One of his initiatives that...
And just explain for listeners, a little bit more
about
Tim Iman.
Well, Tim Iman is a arch conservative, and, you know, he has a lot of money and he funds a lot of regressive measures. So one of the measures that he's been pushing for forever, and, you know, a couple of times it has succeeded now, is requiring the state legislature to have 2/3 majority for putting through any revenue increase, meaning increases have to come from tax increases. So people end up voting for an initiative that makes it harder for the state legislature to collect extra revenues in order to fund the very things that these ordinary people who have been voting need. So, you know, if revenue increase is harder, it means funding education is harder, funding welfare is harder, funding basic health is harder. So you could ask the question, you know, what is wrong with the people of Washington? Why are they doing that? The reason they are doing that is because every time the Democrats have increased revenues, almost every time, they have done it in such a way that the burden of the tax revenue increase falls on ordinary people and low-income people. So of course they rationally are voting against it. So what we need is not some sort of, you know, culture change. What we need is actually a voice in Olympia which will say that, yes, we want a revenue increase, but that revenue increase has to come from the top. You know, there has been a massive redistribution of wealth for decades in the state of Washington, where wealth has flown from ordinary workers and low-income people towards the super wealthy and the multinational corporations we have. So we don't need to tax ordinary people and low-income people. And in fact, we shouldn't. What we should be doing is taxing the wealthy and corporations.
And so you think that you can... So like, for instance, on your platform, you stand for a lot of things. Just two of them being more or less free higher education and more or less free public transportation. Just those two things alone obviously have to cost a lot of money. You think you could raise the money for everything on your platform just by taxing the wealthy more?
Yes, it is actually possible. In fact, if you tax the wealthy and the big corporations more, you will raise more money than what is necessary.
Well, issue about the taxing corporations more. So
I can give you some specific examples.
So I have a question for you about Boeing. So there's about 80,000 Boeing jobs right now in the state of Washington. And the reason that we have that many jobs is that the state has offered huge tax breaks, something on the order of like $3 billion. If your plan is let's tax the corporations more, won't Boeing just move elsewhere?
If you look at, and you mentioned the $3 billion, that's the story I want to talk about. So this was happening in years 2000 through 2003. This was when Gary Locke was the governor. At that time, voters passed in overwhelming numbers for two initiatives. Unfortunately, the numbers of those initiatives escaped me, but both were initiatives for public education, for K-12 schools. One initiative was to provide extra funding to reduce class sizes, and another initiative was to expand funding in order to pay teachers a little bit more, which, by the way, as a teacher, I can tell you we are grossly underpaid and overworked. So if we are talking about democracy, and if you have initiatives that pass not only with a flying majority, but as it was for the class size initiative, it had a historically high majority, and the other initiative had over 60% voting for it. What do you expect the state legislature to do in a democracy? You expect them to actually, you know, make that possible because voters have voted for it. So what happened at that time was that, you know, funding those two initiatives would have needed roughly the same amount of money that they gave to Boeing, $3 billion. At that time, you know, Gary Locke said, well, we just don't have the money for funding these initiatives. Tens of thousands of teachers went to Olympia in March and said, no, you can't do this. Voters have spoken. This is a democracy. We have voted for these initiatives. It's your job to make the funding available. And Gary Locke said, well, no, we don't have the money for it. And then he turned around and gave it to Boeing. And of course, the rationale, stated rationale was that, well, we need to keep corporations happy. Otherwise, they will leave. And the specific issue at that time was the Dreamliner plant. And do you know how many jobs that was going to create? You know, all this money that was going to Boeing, you know how many jobs it was going to create? Less than 2,000 jobs.
Yeah,
and do you know, during that same time, during that same period of a few years, Boeing laid off more than 10,000 workers. So,
but to be fair, they're all back now. We're back to, well, I mean, we're not back to 1998 levels, but we're back to like the 80,000 mark.
No, that is true.
So I mean, to be fair, well, they have stayed here, and we've I think it was around 2,000 jobs in Wichita, Kansas, ended up moving here to Boeing in Washington because of the better tax environment here. Mm-hmm. So the basic question is, they're creating jobs, they're doing good for the economy. If you're actually put in office and you have to make the call, well, do we give Boeing the money or not? Are you really going to be able to say, no, sorry, Boeing, we're not going to give you this money, and then kiss goodbye, you know, however many thousands of jobs? That's a tough call. What would you say?
Well, it's a tough call only because we are limiting ourselves to the thinking that is imposed on us by not only by the capitalist system itself, you know, that's the basic issue, but, you know, more than that, the corporate-controlled political system.
But if you're elected, the place you're going to be.
I know. But the point is that, these are jobs that we need to protect. There's no doubt about that. I mean, in fact, the first thing on my platform is job creation.
Yeah.
However, what I will go, if I get a chance to go to Olympia, is not... neither make deals with Boeing nor provide a lack of options where people say, oh, well, you know, this doesn't make sense. We need jobs. Instead, what I'm going to provide is an alternative where we say that, yes, we need these jobs, but we don't need these overpaid executives. What we need are the Boeing workers, which we have in this state. What we need is the Boeing equipment and machinery created by workers. We have that in this state.
And indeed, in your platform, you say you would want to have worker controlled. You would want to convert Amazon, Boeing, and Microsoft into worker controlled. I guess maybe collectives might be the right word. I don't know.
Yeah, worker controlled democratic. Factories.
Is that even possible on the, like, I mean, realistically, is that ever really going to happen in the U.S.?
Why not? A lot of people said that slavery would never end. A lot of people said that, a lot of people in the civil rights era were saying, no, forget this. You know, don't just focus on your career. This is not going to happen. But guess what? It happened. So what is constant is not status quo. What is constant is change. Capitalism is only a 300 to a 500-year-old system, depending on what you choose as your starting point. It's not etched in stone. There's no reason to think that it's not going to change. But what we do need to do is understand what are the strategies and ideas we need to go towards a much more sustainable, environmentally sustainable, and politically just and economically just society. So yes, as long as we accept, in terms of the previous question, as long as we accept that, we need to provide a tax haven for big corporations, that's the only way they will stay. Yes. By this logic, yes, that's the only way they will stay. But instead, we have an alternative where we can say Washington State can be a pioneer in that by saying that, no, if you want a tax haven on the terms that everybody else has to give up their basic needs, no, we don't want that. The equipment belongs to the people of the state of Washington. The factories belong to the people of the state of Washington. And the workers are in the state of Washington. So if you don't want to stay here, you can go, but we keep the factories here. And it's not...
Isn't that illegal?
Yes, it is illegal. But it's not actually... In fact, I take it back. It's not illegal because the state, as we speak, uses eminent domain to seize private property of ordinary people in order to make way for whatever it is that big corporations want to do. Why can't the people of the state of Washington use that same thing in their favor? This is granted by the Constitution. So why can't we use that in our favor to make sure that the state works not in the interests of a few billionaires, but in the interests of the tens of millions of people in the state? And yes, this is something that may seem new or...
radical is what I would radical, say. Yeah.
But it's not radical if you understand that that is what is necessary in order to create a society which will satisfy the most basic needs of the world. I mean, when people ask me, isn't that radical? You know what my response is? I say that, look, I come from a very poor country, and we are sitting here right now in the wealthiest country, not only in the world, but in the history of humanity. And you're telling me that we cannot solve this problem, basic problem of poverty and lack of healthcare in this country? No, that is nonsense. That does not make sense to me from a political standpoint. It does not make sense for me from my knowledge of economics. No, there's absolutely an unimaginable amount of wealth in this country. What we need is a political voice in Olympia and in Washington, D.C., which will bring forward these ideas. Because people like these ideas. I mean, I can tell you just in a concrete way, we were originally running against Frank Schaap, so we had to collect signatures to be on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to collect only 400 odd signatures, but we ended up collecting 1,052 signatures, in the process of which we talked to over 2,000 people, and I was personally there tabling. I am yet to meet a single person who disagrees with a single point on that platform. Why is that? It's not because it's radical. It's because...
It's because you're in Capitol Hill.
Well, that is true. That is true. It is one of the most liberal districts. And in fact, that's a good point. I mean, the question that people in this district should be asking is, how come we are the voters of probably the five most progressive districts in the United States, and we have representatives that are, you know, doing some really regressive things.
Well, actually, let me redirect you for a second. One of the big criticisms of the Occupy movement was that it didn't seem like it was getting anything done in terms of real political change. You had people on the streets. Yes, they're upset. Yes, they're waving signs, marching, whatever. But can the Occupy movement work within the system of government that we have now to bring about real change? Even to make public transportation free or something like that. I mean, obviously these are huge things that would take years and years and years of legislative pushing to get through.
Well, first of all, I don't actually think that these are really, really, really big things that we're talking about. I mean, if you look at the funding for public transit, in fact, which is actually a relevant thing for us to be talking about because we just got the endorsement of ADU Local 587, you know, the most urgent issue that they're struggling with is that right now there's a very regressive flat car tab tax that funds Metro, but it's not a stable funding. It's going to run out in about 20 months from now, which means that you know, for them, it's going to directly affect the drivers and the employees, because if you have if Metro is not able to find another stable source of funding to replace that, then there's probably going to be a 20-30% cut, which means, you know, layoffs. You know, this is very real for them. But if you look at, first of all, the amount of money that is necessary for provide a stable funding, it's not a huge amount. It's a very small amount. It's only in a few billions of dollars. And also, in terms of, you know, isn't going to take years and years? No, actually, just a few years ago, they had a stable funding. It was what was called MVET, which was a motor vehicle excise tax. What it was a progressive vehicle tax, meaning that if you own a Jaguar, you pay a lot more than if you own a beat-up Civic. It was a larger source of funding because it was progressive, because it raises more money that way, and it was a stable source of funding. It was there. What got rid of it was a series of IMIN initiatives, which, as I mentioned before, end up going through because people have no alternatives, and also because often the Democrats will use, like I said, you know, they will increase revenues, but they will increase it in such a way that it's only a sales tax increase or something, which first of all does not bring in that much money, and also puts all the burden on ordinary people. So in terms of, aren't these huge things that will take us years and years? No. What it will take is a political voice. What it will take is a groundswell from below, which will put pressure on the corporate-controlled legislature, regardless of whether it is Republican or Democrat. If you want to look at concrete gains from the Occupy movement, one example, I've already given you a concrete example, is Occupy Homes. I mean, actually, people's homes have been saved. And not only that, this movement, because it's gaining prominence among the people of Minneapolis and, you know, surrounding areas, suburbs, they've been doing a historic thing, which is that not only are they forcing U.S. Bank and other big banks to renegotiate with the homeowners, not only that, but a really interesting thing that happened is that they not only, in one of the loans, they not only renegotiated the interest rate, but also the principal. This is unheard of. I mean, big banks are rapacious. Sure. They're known for that. So, the Occupy movement has, it's not a perfect movement.
Sure, yeah.
But
so, what do you see for your campaign in the next few months? What are you working on?
Well, right now, the biggest things we are going to be working on, you know, starting this week, is fundraising and door knocking, you know, basically getting the word out. And like I said before, you know, we are a volunteer-run organization. We, like myself, you know, we are giving our personal time. You know, we are not getting any money out of it. So what we really need from people is to join our campaign, but not to join. I mean, what I want people to know is that this is not my campaign. This is our campaign, because the things that I'm running for is not just going to make my life better, but it's going to make everybody, ordinary people's lives better. So we have to treat this campaign as our campaign and our fight. And so people have to proactively become part of the movement. So we can use a lot of help in, doorbelling, handing out flyers. You know, we are trying to hand out flyers several days a week now. And we need, but the other need is fundraising as well. I mean, my opponent, Jamie Peterson, has already probably raised, the last time I checked, he had raised more than $56,000. And a lot of his donors are big corporations. Microsoft is his top donor. We are not taking corporate donations, nor will corporations donate to us because, you know, we are clearly...
Well, that must be an easy choice then.
Yeah. So what we need, I mean, yes, we need, if there are people who have the means to donate hundreds of dollars, that would be greatly appreciated. But we also need large numbers of people to donate small amounts. But we also want to create a mass political party for ordinary people, for the working class. So the left needs to, you know, get that together, and we want to help that happen. And we are absolutely non-sectarian, that what we do want is no compromises with against the interests of ordinary people. Yes, we will make compromises, but we will not make compromises of that nature.
Well, good luck to you. Thanks for coming on the show, Kishama.
Thank you.